and welcome to The Price of Football, the pod that follows the money behind the beautiful game and unwittingly starts arguments amongst Luton Town fans. I'm Kevin Day, and he's Kieran Maguire, football finance expert at Liverpool University. He's in a different place to me, don't worry. He's socially distancing himself, mainly from Luton fans at the moment. We didn't mean to do that. It was just a very innocent interview, which was, it got picked up and went all over the place, but yeah.
Gary was very honest and passionate about his involvement with the club, and fair play to him. I think those people that perhaps just looked at the headlines and didn't have a full listen perhaps might have misconstrued some of his comments.
Yeah, well, see, as your mum would say, what it needed was a proper interview, Kieran.
Absolutely.
Really. You let the monkey start running the barrel organ, then all sorts of things could happen. Now, coming up, Kieran has raised his profile yet again with some very good research into the value of Premier League clubs. We're starting a bit late because I was only third in the queue behind various other media organisations. Apparently Sky get in before Price of Football. There you go. UEFA are getting edgy and the first club to lay players off due to the virus. But first, Kieran, remember Brexit?
Just about.
Those were the days, weren't they? Happy, carefree times. And that's all we had to worry about was a country being economically ruined. but we had some discussion shortly before this all kicked off about what would happen post-Brexit transfer-wise with foreign players. And we got some more details now, haven't we?
Yes. Yesterday, the Football Association published its annual report. And as it contained numbers, I was sort of diving into a spreadsheet, but then I started to look at the small print as well, and it did make reference to Brexit there. But what we've also seen coming out is effectively EU countries are going to be treated identically to non-EU countries when it comes to the recruitment of players. So this means that if somebody wants to play football in England, he's going to be assessed on four criteria. So first of all, it's the number of caps that he's won, and that's sort of a sliding scale in terms of the number of caps over the last sort of year or two. Secondly, the FIFA World Ranking of his team, which I always found myself to be a bit of a weird one, because I remember I used to go and watch Liverpool occasionally, because working there, and when Yari Litmanen used to play for them, and he was absolutely fantastic player, but he played for Finland, whose FIFA ranking was never too good, so he would therefore struggle. So it's not the player, it's the country which is taken into consideration. Then the transfer fee: the bigger the fee, the more likely you are to be recruited. And finally, the wage of the player relative to other players in that particular division. So what this will result in is that the big clubs, the clubs that can afford the big wages and the big transfer fees, they will now be able to recruit players from the EU and outside of the EU. And I don't think it will impact upon them. But if we take a look at our clubs, Brighton Palace, the clubs of that stature, they're going to find it that much more difficult, because getting enough points, because it is a sort of it's a complicated, it involves spreadsheets, so I'm happy, but it's a complicated nature of whether or not somebody qualifies to play in England.
There's a couple of issues there, and I'll pause only to say that Yari Litmanen, and I saw him take Palace apart once in a League Cup game. It was a personal masterclass. We had Aki Rialati. He wasn't quite as good a Finnish player, but he was up there. The number of caps one, first of all, is interesting, because Wilfried Zaha, for example, say he were Belgian, it's easier to get caps for the Ivory Coast than it is for France. So you can have a player who's arguably not as good as another player, but has got a lot of caps for Malta or a smaller country. And the thing, so you, basically what you're saying is the higher the wages, the more boxes he ticks.
Yes.
So essentially that's a get out clause, as you say, for the wealthier clubs. But does that mean that clubs will then be forced to divulge the wages to everybody, or just to the Department of Employment or wherever it is that makes a decision?
Well, it would go before a Premier League panel, who would then pass on the information to the DOE, and on that basis the decision would be made. Now, we would not find out, and I think that's right and proper. We don't have a right to know somebody else's wages, and the obsession with football players' individual wages is something which has always mystified me.
So is your instinct, it won't mean fewer foreign players in the Premier League, but it may mean fewer foreign players outside the top six of the Premier League?
Yes. Now, there has been, the Premier League did try to push back much further on this. Because I think the non-Big Six clubs have expressed their concern. There are potential positives. If you are an academy player from an English club, you've now got a better chance of breaking into the team. So, you know, there's always winners and losers. And also, you know, if you are an established English player, then you've got less competition when it comes to renewing your contract. So therefore, I think you're in a strong negotiating position with your present employer, or if you want to go to another English club. So as always, there's winners and losers. The Football Association did say in its accounts that it was concerned about the knock-on effect of the quality of the game that's produced by the Premier League, and whether this might longer term have an impact upon the sale of broadcasting rights, because if the product's not as good, then people won't be as willing to pay as much money.
Well, also the timing's not brilliant, because you've been speaking for a couple of weeks about the fact that this is going to be a buyer's market. Clubs will be paying less money for transfers, you presume offering lower wages. So in effect, that's going to work against this point system then, isn't it? They won't be able to have it both ways. They won't be able to get players as bargains and also get them work permits.
Yes, I think this is a potential issue, because as it is a buyer's market, I think the ability of clubs to offer the wages which perhaps they were offering 12 months ago simply doesn't exist, because clubs themselves don't have the money coming in. And therefore, if it's going to be benchmarked against average wages in the Premier League, I think it's going to cause a major hurdle in terms of recruitment, unless, of course, you are Big Six clubs recruiting at Big Six prices.
Now, can we move on, Kieran? Because we've all got a bit of time on our hands at the moment, and somebody like me, if I've got nothing to do, I might revisit a book, I might watch an old film, for example, learn a new language. Who knows? What you do, obviously, is look into the value of every Premier League club relative to where it was a year ago. And it's been causing some interest. And are there any surprises in there?
I think there are quite a few surprises. First of all, last year when we did this exercise, we valued Manchester City as the most valuable club, and that caused people to kick off because they felt it wasn't warranted, although Manchester City was subsequently sold, or a proportion of them sold, was in November, which did actually tie in with the values. What we've seen for 2019, based on the accounts, is Spurs come from nowhere, in effect, to steal the top spot. They've leapfrogged over both the Manchester clubs, and the reason for that is Spurs as a business is a really smart operation. They delivered a Champions League final, they delivered a top four finish, and all of the prize money and the rewards that go along with that on a wage budget that was 100 to 150 million pounds less than that of the two Manchester clubs and Liverpool.
So we should stress, these are all based on tangible comparative facts that you've researched. This is not your instinct. This is actual figures that prove that Tottenham is arguably then the wealthiest club in the Premier League.
That's right. I use something called the Markham multivariate model, which is a book I encourage you to read if you've not read it already.
What did I say earlier about rereading old favourites? I shall get my well-thumbed copy. I've already forgotten what it's called. Carry on.
Right. Well, this model, it looks at how many tickets you sell as a proportion of capacity, because that shows how popular you are. How good are you at controlling wages? Are you generating profits? Do you have a strong balance sheet? All the really dull stuff that gets me very giggity in terms of excitement. So I plug those all into exactly the same model, because that I don't want any bias in this. Spurs came out top. They are a very smart organisation in terms of keeping the wage bill low. They were the most profitable club in the Premier League last season. So I think that was one surprise. I think the other one was the success of Wolverhampton Wanderers. Yeah, they were bought by Fosun 2 or 3 years ago. I think it was 2016 for around about £40 million. I've valued them at 10 times that figure because they've come in, they come into the Premier League. They've been a breath of fresh air, a seventh place finish. And you know, Premier League prize money is allocated on the basis of how often are you on the telly and where do you finish in the table. So they've punched above their weight. And I'm sure the owners would be delighted to have had such a successful club, both on and off the pitch.
This may be a difficult question to answer, actually, before I get onto something more specific. But when it comes to Wolves, could you argue then that playing attractive football has tangibly added to the value of that football club?
Yes, it has, in the sense that if we're looking at the income generated by a club, that's split into match day, commercial and broadcasting. Now, we know that practically every club in the Premier League is selling out, so you can't do anything with match day income. So if we then therefore look at the variables, you know, what's going to make a difference on a week-by-week or month-by-month basis, Wolves playing attractive football means that they're attractive to broadcasters. And the way that it works is that you give your first 10 matches to the Premier League for nothing under the general deal, but every match which is more than 10, you're picking up an extra £1 to £1.5 million from the broadcasters. Now, no disrespect, if you look at the previous season, who came seventh? It was Burnley. But Burnley were only shown live on TV 7 times. They got paid for 10, but they're only picked up by BT and Sky 7 times. That's because the perception, and I don't think the perception is the same as reality. Sean Dyche is one of those managers who gets a reputation, I think, which counts against him. If you actually take a look at the way Burnley play football, they play some pretty good stuff, and they've got the lad McNeil, who's come through this season, who looks an absolute super player. But that counted against Burnley finishing seventh. The Wolves style of football, which is a delight to watch, means that the broadcasters are more likely to pick up on them.
Yeah, well done there for pausing for thought and deciding that you want to keep Burnley fans happy because you got enough on your plate with Luton fans. Let's all agree that Burnley play some rather attractive football, or are capable of it. Any surprises in the bottom end of this financial league table?
Well, Bournemouth came bottom at just under £100 million. Now, I appreciate they've got a small ground and so on. But that didn't look great. That was quite a big drop. I guess a couple of clubs who, and I've already seen things in the Liverpool Echo, so I'm talking to them shortly after we finish this interview.
You're a tart, you know that. You are simply, I thought I was a... Carry on.
But the value of Everton was surprisingly low, at around about £250 million. But the reason for that is that they've been sort of caught by both sides. They can't increase income till they move to the new stadium. So therefore, they've got Goodison, which is great to visit from a history and heritage point of view.
Yeah.
But if you're 6 foot three like I am, there's no way you can sit down because there's not enough room in the seats. So it's a great place to visit. But Everton are a traditional working class club, and therefore they price tickets accordingly. So they don't generate a lot of income. Under the new owner Farhad Moshiri, what Everton have done is that they've spent a fortune recruiting players, Sigurdsson, Richarlison and so on, Theo Walcott. All of those players have come to Goodison and they are being paid significant wages. So Everton lost over £100 million last season. And if you're a business that's losing money, that's going to affect your value. So that was one. And I think West Ham was the other. Karen Brady on her website says that the club are worth £800 million. I came in at a fraction of that. And again, I think it's because they're paying wages, which are high. You can get a cheap season ticket at the London Stadium. So I think the fans were promised one thing and they've not quite delivered in terms of it's difficult to make a lot of money out of the London Stadium if you're West Ham, because ultimately they're tenants rather than owners.
Yeah, somebody pointed out, I always refer to Goodison Park. My biggest compliment about a ground is I'll say it's a proper ground, proper ground. And Goodison Park, proper ground. And somebody pointed that to me recently, that normally the grounds I say proper a bit ramshackle, a bit run down. You wouldn't necessarily want to go there as a tourist. So it is my biggest compliment. It doesn't necessarily mean a lot. You've just touched on something there, Kieran. Are you rattling a few cages here? I mean, are you, if your valuation, which is being publicised as we know, mainly by you, but if it is being made well known, and it doesn't tally with what a club are publicly saying, you could be. I'm not suggesting you don't walk down any dark alleys in the East End, but you are open for a little bit of criticism here, aren't you? If your version tallies, because you know it could affect potential buyers and investors, couldn't it?
I think it's one model. Yeah, there are lots of others. Which if I was involved in a deal, I'd be looking across a range of ways of valuing a football club. Yeah, the one that I use is sort of a quick and dirty one, which is still puts a lot of time into it. But
of course, you use a quick and dirty one. If I knew there was a quick and dirty option, that'd be the one I'd assume that you used. Mrs. McGuire's out again, isn't she?
She is indeed. Yes.
Yeah, I thought she might be.
Walking the dog. So, yeah, it's one method. But it works at times. We valued Arsenal 2 years ago, and that worked out as being 99.98% accurate when Silent Stan bought out Usmanov. So it doesn't work every time, but it's a good start point for negotiations. I'm fully aware that the West Ham owners actually turned down 800 million for an offer for the club, and that's probably ties in with Karen Brady's comments on the website. And I suspect at present they're crying into their whatever they use to occupy themselves as a result of rejecting that particular deal, because I think they'd struggle to get those numbers for the club today.
In your reluctance to avoid saying crying into their beer for some reason, you came up with something much more sinister. Now, before we leave on this subject, I have to ask, obviously, the oldest football club in the league, Crystal Palace, comfortably mid-table, I hope.
Yeah, this is not a criticism. Well, it is a criticism of Palace, I guess. They've not published their accounts. So I've had to value them on 2018 figures. They came out at 200 million, which you'll be delighted to know was slightly above Brighton.
Of course.
But you know, if you could have a word with Mr. Parrish and if he could forward me the accounts, I could do a proper valuation for them. And yeah, that could push them higher up the table. Yeah, they're the only club, along with Newcastle, who haven't published.
I believe, and I don't know why, but I believe historically we are always late to publish our results. I don't know why. I will have a word with Steve Parrish, but probably not about that. Now, obviously, if you've had a busy meal with the Premier League clubs, you like nothing better than a sorbet, Kieran, just to clear the palate afterwards. So you had a look at Brentford's accounts as well, didn't you? And I would guess that Brentford are a club on the up, aren't they? On and off the pitch.
Yeah, the Brentford model is an intriguing one in that they recruit players using one of these Moneyball approaches. Their owner, Matthew Benham, he owns Smart Odds, the company, and he's huge into his data. So what happens with Brentford is that they lose money on a day-to-day basis. You know, the wage bill is still higher than their income. But what they've done every year since they've been promoted from League One to the Championship is that they've found players, they've spotted talent. They don't have an academy. What they do instead is that they look at players who are being rejected by other clubs in London, and they say, come and play for us. And that model has worked because they have made around about £130 million in profits from selling players. As a business model, I teach business at university. I think it's a really clever approach. They're making more money sort of over that 5-year period from player sales than practically everybody else. And they do it because they believe in the data in terms of identifying particular characteristics. They always go for younger players, with a view to moving them on within a couple of years. Tarkovsky went to Burnley, and he's established himself as a centre half. He's on the England player. They sold Neil Mopay to us for 15 to 20 million, made a huge profit on that. And they are very, very good at this particular approach to football.
Yeah, and anybody travelling west out of London in the past 2 years has been able to see that rather smart-looking new stadium in progress. I presume that's going to greatly improve match day income as well, is it?
Yeah, I mean, as a fan, probably like you, I love going to Brentford. There's always a cracking atmosphere there.
Yeah.
Although I got into a lot of trouble the last time I was there, because I ended up in the director's box and I made the mistake of celebrating a 97th minute goal for us, which didn't go down well there. It's the only time I've ever been in a director's box. It'll never go again because it's not for somebody like me who's a bit gobby. But it's a fantastic ground. You've got the four pubs on the corner of the stadium. So I can go for the full remit of lime and soda there. But the new ground is pretty close. It will be bigger. It will allow them to generate more money from boxes and hospitality and so on. Part of you always sheds a silent tear when clubs do move, though, from one ground to another.
I've got a theory that the only reason they are moving is because they're so fed up with. That's the only fact everybody knows about Brentford. As soon as you mention Brentford, everyone goes, "Oh yeah, pub on every corner." Yeah, really. We hadn't noticed, really. although one day, if you're good, I'll tell you Bradley Walsh's Bill Dodgin story when he was playing for Brentford Reserves, which is one of my favourite TV moments. A TV show with an audience, I would say, none of whom were over the age of 30, and Bradley started talking about Bill Dodgin, who was manager of Brentford in the mid 70s, which was, oh man, actual tumbleweed in the studio. It was great. And now, unfortunately, we have to move on to the more topical issues with the continuing crisis. We mentioned the domino effect in Europe last week, and it's all been starting to happen. France has now cancelled their football, becoming the biggest country to do so. UEFA are getting a little bit edgy, it seems. They've given every country until the 25th of May to make a final decision about whether or not they continue, haven't they?
Yes, and I think if you look what's happening to England, you know, we're starting to be surrounded. You know, the Netherlands, yeah. Belgium, France, Scotland, football there has all been cancelled. I appreciate it's still going in potentially in the Premiership in Scotland, but the lower leagues are being closed down. Certainly looking at the noises coming out of other countries, President Macron said that I don't want people gathering 22 guys on a pitch. I don't think it's right for health and safety. And I think there's also that there is a danger is that if things do start to progress and we have not really made it in terms of the health issues, we might subconsciously start to stop the social isolation ourselves. And I think that's part of the fear that they have in France. So it's not as lucrative a league as the Premier League in terms of the TV deal. And I'm just wondering now, is the Premier League and the EFL, are those leagues continuing purely because of money issues and the fear of individual clubs suing the authorities on the basis of relegation, promotion and things of this nature? So the lower leagues, certainly here in England, are being split. You've got the likes of Darragh Anthony at Peterborough, who has been very, very vocal in terms of saying that football must continue under practically under all circumstances. You've got other owners saying we can't afford to do it because we have to take the players out to furlough. We've got to pay them therefore the wages and we've got nothing coming in.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Yeah, in Germany and Italy, the authorities there have been very vocal in the past few weeks about, you know, ensuring that football will continue. My instinct is starting to be that 2 weeks ago, I was absolutely convinced that football would find a way of completing the fixtures. I still hope they do. I still think it's the right thing to do. But as each day goes by, I can't help but think that it might be next season. It might be they just say, look, we have to clear the decks and try and start next season and then deal with the financial legislation, the legal aspects of it afterwards, because clubs like Leeds wouldn't take that decision lying down. But I mean, there's going to come a time where next season won't start till March, so it's these decisions have to be made, and luckily we're not the people who have to make them. UEFA are also consulting about the new club competitions, aren't they, from 2024?
That's right. Again, this was something which came up in the Football Association annual report, but it was unusual to see it as starkly written as that. What the proposals will mean is that there's now going to be sort of 96 clubs potentially taking place in three competitions of 32. But the key issue which the FA raised that would be that there would have to be another 8 European games. Now, we've already got fixture congestion. We've had this discussion before. If there is going to be fixture congestion, how do we alleviate it? England's realistically the only country which is a second cup competition. We know, as supporters of Premier League clubs, that our clubs don't give it perhaps don't take it over seriously. If you get knocked out, nobody sheds a tear over that particular issue. So the Carabao Cup has got to look very vulnerable. Certainly replays as far as the FA Cup, they're looking vulnerable as well. But it's that my concern there is that's great as far as the elite clubs are concerned. But if you are Walsall, Accrington, Morecambe, it's getting that occasional windfall, which does make a hell of a difference to your finances. So the gap between the big and the smaller clubs is going to grow further. And I think the other potential issue could be a push to have the Premier League reduced to 18 teams. Now, clearly, everybody's going to be resisting that if you're not one of the top clubs. But they will then threaten to set up the European Super League and leave the other clubs. So a lot of negotiations going to be taking place. Hopefully some form of decent compromise can be made. Perhaps that as a result of the second club competition going and FA Cup replays, that more money will filter down to the smaller clubs. Because as we've said all along, and I appreciate we are romantics as far as the game, football club is more than a football club. It is that integral part of the community. I went to some of the meetings in Bury. There's things kicking off about Bury as well this week. You don't want to see any community leave the club and also lose its own identity.
Yeah, hear, hear. I think it says a lot about our different approaches to this pod, Kieran, that you've read the FA annual report from cover to cover. And I'd never heard of it. But I think that's why we're so popular, because I think we cover both the bases. We have the proper research scientists and we have the lazy ass reporter who just picks up a script and reads it out, basically. I did, however, in the course of my research for another project, discover an even more pointless European competition. I remember the Anglo-Italian Cup because Palace played in it, but I'd forgotten there was an Anglo-Italian League Cup for two seasons where the winners of the League Cups in England and Italy played the smallest tournament in the world. And of course, one of them was stopped for crowd trouble, but there you go. I also discovered, now this story I did know about, because I was writing for Have I Got News For You the other day, and one of the websites we were, I can't remember what story it would have been, why, but we ended up on the East Anglian version of the BBC, so I knew about this story. Colchester United had become the first team to lay players off because of the coronavirus. But it appears, from the research I did accidentally, it's mainly older players and players that were coming to the end of their contract anyway. Is that right?
Yes and no. I mean, it involves their captain. All the players involved have played at least 20 times this season. So it's not as if they're peripheral. But what the club owner has said is that in an ideal world, he would be offering these players new contracts when they expire at the 30th of June. He doesn't think he can afford it, so he's letting them know now. So he's still going to pay them up to the 30th of June. But normally, if you think about it, a club's retained list you would normally put out, you know, in the week after the season ends and the club makes that particular announcement. The fact that Colchester are announcing it now, I guess it's sad in a way for the players because they're going to have to find a new club, but at least the club is giving them the opportunity to start making those phone calls earlier than they would other have to do so. There are going to be hundreds of professional footballers desperately seeking jobs when it comes to the end of June, and that, as we've discussed, that can cause a very big mess in terms of who are you contracted to from the 1st of July if the season goes beyond that date. And I think unless there can be an agreement made between players who've got to look after their own families and they've got bills to pay, either via their representatives or the PFA and clubs, we could end up in an absolute mire come the start of July if the seasons haven't finished by then.
It does indicate yet again, Kieran, I think, as it did with the Luton interview last week, that club chairmen at that level are trying at least their very best to manage this situation in as decent a way as possible. And it's very unfortunate that these players are being laid off, but he has tried to soften the impact. He is paying them a certain amount of money. They're not panicking, are they? Club owners, club CEOs seem to be, for the most part, acting responsibly and are aware of their responsibilities, not only to their club, but to the community as well.
Yes, I think what we have seen in the vast majority of cases is that clubs have really stepped up in terms of trying to keep fans as in the loop as they can expect to be. You know, ultimately, it's a private conversation between owner and player, but I think that the clubs have been relatively honest. Some of the activities by clubs in making facilities available to the NHS and other frontline services has made me proud to be a football fan. At the same time, there's been one or two others where you think that doesn't reflect too well. If we take Bristol City yesterday, they announced that they're going to be furloughing a lot of their backroom staff, but they're not going to be topping up the wages. So, you know, at present, you get 80% of the wages up to $2,500 a month. They're not going to be doing that top up. They have got a deferment with the players, but the players are going to be paid 100% of the wages. Now, so why is that? Well, it's because the players can be sold as commodities. And, you know, with due respect to Doris the tea lady, she can't. And that makes you feel slightly uneasy, especially when the owner of Bristol City Football Club, who has put a lot of money in historically, is a billionaire who lives in the Channel Islands.
Yeah, okay. I almost wish I hadn't asked that. Even as I was saying, making that little impassioned speech on behalf of club owners, I could see the glint in your eye that you were going to contradict me. But that's fine. That's how it works. Also, when you're talking about football and being proud of football, I think that there isn't a single club where the fans, in their numbers, haven't stepped up. The imaginative ways that football fans are using to raise money for the local communities and sometimes for their club, that's really made me proud to be a football fan. And you know, umpteen different Palace groups are raising money in different ways, whether it's through auctions, charity walk. Mark Bright did a sponsored silence the other day, which killed him. It's seriously, generally, I could do that fine. People are really, really doing good things, and that's what's made me proud to be. I've always been proud to be a football fan. We both have, but we've always acknowledged that there are elements in football, as there are in every society, that aren't brilliant. But I think football fans have been wonderful in this crisis, and I'm proud to be one of them.
Yeah, and I think we've also had this discussion. People who don't get football, they are missing out on something because we're not idiots, we're not oiks, we're not hooligans. We are, you know, sons and brothers and mums and dads, and the efforts put in by clubs all over the country is absolutely superb.
Yeah, it's just some of us like a dirty spreadsheet more than others, Kieran, that's all. Let's end for once on an optimistic note. Even allowing for what I said earlier, that my fears each day goes by is that the season won't continue. And for those of you just joining us, that's a fear, my fear. It's not based on any information. But there is a glimmer of hope, and that is that three Premier League clubs, one of them is yours, Brighton, happy to acknowledge that, plus Arsenal, plus West Ham, have now allowed players back into the training ground for individual training. you know, subject, of course, to all the proper social distancing measures. So that is one little glimmer of hope on the horizon that that we might be getting towards whatever normality is in the near future.
That's right. And, you know, clearly individual clubs have made decisions. They're in daily communication with players. But training by yourself, you know, working out, doing exercises, it isn't the same as operating within a unit. I think those players that have been allowed to use club facilities will have come to a very sterile environment. So it won't be the, you know, the dressing room environment that even if you're playing Sunday League football is such a joy going back to your youth. But it's a start, and anything which I think we can cling on to as a positive, we will do. The Premier League is hoping to start ideally on the 7th of June. There's a meeting taking place this Friday amongst the clubs. That will require full training, I think, to commence around about the 16th of May. So we've got just over a fortnight. You know, effectively, it will be, you know, a fortnight Monday. If clubs then go into training, I think we'll all be celebrating because everybody has sort of bought into lockdown, but you want something to look forward to, and this could be the case. At the same time, nobody can justify money being taken away and resources, you know, the PPE resources being taken away from anybody that is putting their life on the line on a daily basis in other industries.
Yeah, but as you say, it's a start. I can't remember a very wise man. It was either Confucius or Bilbo Baggins, who technically is a hobbit. So it was a wise man. One of them said that a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. So this at least is a single step. Now, today's Thursday. So it's our normal pod today, the one we discuss the big issues. We'll be back on Monday with our questions pod. If you have any questions to put to us about any issue regarding football finance, questions at priceoffootball.com is what you want. Luton fans, you probably have a week off. You've asked Kieran most of the questions via social media, and he's dealing with some of them. God bless him. So we'll see you again on Monday. I hope you have a good weekend. It's my birthday of the weekend, Kieran.
Oh, very happy day.
Yeah, well, it won't be, but, you know, it'll be fine. It'll be the same as you. I might have a special trip to the co-op. Who knows? That'd be great. The Price of Football is Adapted production. We hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you soon. Stay safe. Have a good weekend.
The Price of Football.
Cheerio, folks.
Price of Football.